You know, one of the impressive features of the churches that are of Christ, those churches that follow the New Testament pattern, is the simplicity of its government. We have elders, we have deacons, we have preachers, we have teachers. That's it. We don't have any special offices or really any designations beyond that. That doesn't mean if you're not a teacher that you're not involved. What I'm talking about is just specific positions of responsibility in that church. And compare that with major denominations, for example. There you see priests and apostles and reverends and cardinals and rectors and youth pastors and ward leaders and fathers, and I mean that as a title, and popes. Or even if you look at major corporations like Boeing or Microsoft or Starbucks with their complex hierarchy of functions and positions and vice presidents and managers and salesmen and researchers and clerks and office people, office staff, and so on. We are not a bureaucracy. We are not a hierarchical system in the sense of, you know, we have different strata or layers of Christians. That's not how we are. We're all one. We're all working together toward a common cause. The church's otherworldly task is more important than all companies on earth combined. Its work, its people have to do with the afterlife. All the companies combined in this life have to do with this life. We deal directly with someone infinitely greater and more powerful and wealthier than Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates or Warren Buffett. Common names to us because they're very wealthy people. We deal with the creator of all of this world and all of its wealth. And so the Church of Christ may appear to be insignificant in comparison to, say, Boeing or Microsoft and so on. But its mission is more important, and its members, being faithful, are more successful. And yet, we have a simple and straightforward structure. As I said, we have no hierarchy, we have no layers, we have no bureaucracy, but we all have responsibilities, and we all cooperate together in that work. Every member is involved in some way. Elders are appointed to oversee individual congregations, but we have one Lord overseeing all elders and all other souls as well. Elders are not super intellectual men. They are not necessarily well-educated. They don't necessarily have college degrees. They don't have to go to seminary. They don't have to produce some kind of award given to them by some congregation or certificates or even have a DD after their name, Doctor of Divinity. Furthermore, they are fallible. They are imperfect. They are capable of bad judgments. They are capable of unpopular decisions. They are very human. In other words, in a very spiritual organization. So just trying to, you know, see elders and in a sense ourselves in the context of this perfect organization. And yet, having said all that, there's nothing ordinary about being an elder. First of all, Christians are not ordinary people. They're not typical people in themselves. I know we sometimes talk about that. Well, he's a typical Christian. Well, what does that mean? There's nothing typical about being a Christian, especially a faithful one. And second, they're handpicked leaders. They should be, and I speak ideally. They're the cream of the crop. They've taken years and even decades to prepare themselves to serve the most important job in the world from God's perspective. And that's just something we need to keep in front of us. What criteria, what information should we use to select such men? Notice that there are no resumes handed out. There is no management training seminars. There's no formal interviews. There's no IQ tests. Christians often reduce the appointment of elders to job qualifications, and yet God's criteria is that of character issues and leadership skills. Okay, that's something extremely important that we should focus on and will continue to focus on, not only in this series, but hopefully going forward in our work here. Character issues, leadership skills. Congregations traditionally tend to be more critical than realistic when choosing their elders, often holding those men to a far higher standard than themselves. And that's not a good thing. That's something that we want to work on and try to correct. We are terrified. I say we, not necessarily here, but we in the brotherhood seem to be very terrified of appointing what we might call an unqualified man. And so we meticulously scrutinize and dissect the list of qualifications in order to weed out, as we see it, all those imperfect men and men that might have any blemish or any kind of situation that we feel is going to compromise his work. Well, there's two things. Before I say that, I want to say on the heels of what I just said, there are no perfect matches, by the way. And this forces us to realize not who's perfect, but who can get the job done. If you're looking for a perfect man, there's only one, and that is Jesus, and he's not our elder in the congregational sense. And so anyone else is going to be less than that. We just need to accept that. First of all, it does take a spiritual and disciplined man who is committed to the Lord to hold the office of an overseer. It's just hands down, it's what it takes. Secondly, it takes a spiritual-minded, submissive, Christ-loving congregation to appoint such a man. Those two things become evident. We need a spiritual, capable, responsible man to hold that position. We also need a spiritual-minded, Christ-centered congregation to appoint him to that position. Can't emphasize that enough. Let's get into the details here. We have to address, first of all, the office of an overseer or of an elder or a shepherd of the church is a man and not a woman. Sadly, I have to say that in our modern society where we're focusing on feminism and, you know, women's rights and why can't women do what men do and, you know, and women can do just what men do even better sometimes. And I'm not even disagreeing with that. That's not the point, though. The point is that God wants a man in this position. That means that this man has to be a man. And he's not a woman, and it's not the wife of the man either that is being appointed. I think all this would seem obvious 25, 30 years ago. Now we have to really clarify it. Everyone needs to know their place. Preachers need to know their place. Deacons need to know their place. Men need to know their place. Women need to know their place. Preachers and elders' wives need to know their place. An elder's wife is not on par with her husband. She does not share the same oversight or responsibility. She is not held to the same standard. We are not appointing couples. We're not appointing married couples when we appoint an elder. Again, I cannot stress that enough because you probably have seen, like I have seen, over the course of your Christian life in many different congregations where wives have really been the elder. In cases where a man is weak and allows his wife to dictate his role as an elder. Elder's wife is not qualified to be an elder. She is not appointed to be an elder. She is not allowed to act by default as an elder. At the same time, if an elder candidate will not stand up to his own wife or his children, especially when it's unpopular to do so, how in the world is he going to stand up to a congregation and make, and hold his convictions and hold the truth or stand for the truth? If he can't do it at home, why would we believe he's going to do it here? And Paul does address that later on. We'll get into that. What kind of man is he to be? And of course, everyone's going to say, well, he needs to be qualified. There's that word again, qualified. What does that mean? It sounds pretty rigid. It sounds rather clinical. It sounds kind of mechanical, actually, like you're certified or you have some kind of degree. And someone might say, well, we just go to the list there in 1 Timothy 3 and in Titus chapter 1. And I agree that there are specific details that are given to us there in those passages. But I want you to compare those two passages and you'll find that they are not identical. And that begs a question. Did Paul write two different lists to two different men? Or, according to the context, did he write the same list spoken in two different ways? There is a Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. There is kind of an abridged or abbreviated sermon of the same nature in Luke chapter 6. They do not read the same. It is very likely, I'm going to put forward not to get off track here at all, but to make my point, it's very likely that Jesus gave the same lesson to a different group of people and different things were said, but he meant the same things. He came to the same conclusions no matter how he said it. And isn't that what Paul is doing in 1 Timothy and Titus? He's talking about the same thing. Paul expounds upon things in 1 Timothy that he doesn't expound upon in Titus, and vice versa. And yet he's talking about the same job or the same office. The question comes to us then, if Timothy appointed an elder based on what Paul told him in Timothy, and if Titus appointed an elder based on what Paul told him in Titus, would they be appointing the same kind of man? The answer is absolutely yes. And that should clue us in to what we're looking for. We're not just looking for checklists and meticulous details about, you know, specific scrutinizing of this or that. We're looking at the big picture. What kind of man? And that's why I say that we come down to character issues and leadership skills. Qualifications is our word, by the way. It's not even in the scripture with regard to elders. It's not even in the New Testament. And if we understand Paul's intent, then he is describing men with certain character issues and certain leadership skills, and that should change everything for us, for the better. We're not scouring the man's entire life. We're not judging every decision that he's ever made. We're not checking his resumes. Rather, Paul, by inspiration, said, look at the man's heart as determined by his actions, as measured over time. And that is extremely important to see that. Look at his marriage, look at his family, look at his household, not in a given week, not 20 years ago or 30 or 50 years ago. Look at what we have seen since we have known him in the fairly recent past, say 5 or 10 years, enough time to see what kind of person he has been in that time. What kind of man is he? Is he mature? Is he experienced? Is he hardworking? Does he honor Christ? Does he sanctify Christ as Lord of his heart? 1 Peter 3:15. You're examining character here, not hiring points. And if you look at both lists in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, you'll notice that neither one of them is exhaustive, nor is it meant to be exhaustive. You can see the same thing in a different context there. Acts chapter 1, verse 21 through 26, for example. You see there the so-called qualifications for a replacement apostle for Judas, who committed suicide when they chose finally Matthias. And Peter gives out some things to look for here. Obviously, the list is not comprehensive. It's certainly not exhaustive. But it does tell you basically what kind of person we're looking for. And if Peter had said that same thing to maybe a different group of people, he might have said different words, but he would have meant the same thing. He would have came to the same conclusion. Ironically, it's interesting that Paul doesn't say anything about a man's willingness to solve problems or work out solutions for other people, even though this is extremely common for all leaders, in any case, secular or religious. He doesn't say anything about the man's ability to deal with sensitive or personal situation, although this is specifically expected of elders, because that's part of their shepherding that they do. He doesn't say anything about the man being forgiving or compassionate, but obviously those two qualities are necessary. He doesn't say anything about the man not being a liar or vulgar mouth or using coarse jesting, but mature men certainly don't engage in those things. He doesn't say anything about the man's marriage, whether it is successful or not. In fact, interestingly, there is nothing said, unless you look at 1 Timothy 3:11 and think that that's talking about an elder's wife. There's nothing said about an elder's wife whatsoever. And yet, you realize that his marriage needs to be fulfilling and cooperative and serve as a fine example, because that's a reasonable expectation. How can a man talk to others about their married life if his is in shambles? If his is dysfunctional and unsuccessful? Doesn't even say whether or not he's a Christian. And yet, of course, he must be a Christian. We know that by implication. That's underlying all that is said. You see what I'm saying here? There's some things that are missing that you would think would be there, but they don't have to be there, because we're not looking at qualifications to hire someone for a job in the secular context. We're looking at character issues and leadership skills. And that's what we should be focusing on. Just because something is not specifically mentioned does not mean it is not important. God wants us to use this brain that he's given us, and it's called common sense that he wants us to exercise in this case. For example, if a man's wife is rebellious and offensive and domineering, well, we can't ignore that because that says a lot about the man himself because he allows her to be that way. And he's not reining her in or training her to be submissive. And how is that going to reflect upon the congregation? So we ought not to appoint such a man. If a candidate's finances are always in trouble, he's in excessive debt, he's always broke, he exercises poor financial stewardship, well, you can just expect that if he's doing that in his private life, he's going to carry that over, that fiscal irresponsibility, if you will, over into the congregation's situation. If the candidate has a history of not holding a job for long or bouncing around from job to job, that indicates instability. Why would you appoint a man who proves to be unstable in a position that requires him to be stable? That just doesn't make sense. If a candidate is afraid of people or is easily intimidated, well, he's not a good candidate for an office in which he needs to confront people and not be intimidated by them. If a candidate is lazy and unmotivated and too passive, he's unqualified, not because of any specific list in 1 Timothy or Titus, but because he has the wrong character. He's not producing the kind of fruit or the kind of character that we expect in a mature individual, regardless of whether it's on a list or not. I'm saying all this so we can get out of this list mentality, but understand that the lists are there for a reason. We are going to go through the list here in just a moment, okay? So I don't want you to think that we're against the list. We're not against that, but you need to see it for what it is. We need to see that for what it is. Not every man should be an elder just because he's older. There are a bunch of older men, as you well know. Probably look at your family or, you know, we just had Thanksgiving. You might have had family members who are older that were questionable. Okay, let me just say that delicately. Or lack maturity or ability. A Christian character is not something that automatically happens with age. It is something that is chosen. It is something that is studied. And it is something that is practiced. The idea of a man being qualified simply because he's a longtime Christian and he's an older man and happens to be married and have children, that is a foreign concept to the New Testament. That's not what we are looking for in itself. If that's all it took, well, we can find those anywhere. In fact, we don't even need the church for that. We can just look out in society and find that. Older men with wives and children. Who are, well, older, okay? And so not every characteristic in the Paul's listing in 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 1 is necessary to be mature. In other words, you don't have to be mature to be married. There's a lot of immature married people. You don't have to be mature to have children. By the way, anybody can have children, you know? I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out how to do that. But if you're going to be a candidate for the eldership, then that is necessary. You do have to have those details. Most of the characteristics listed by Paul don't even require a man to be a Christian. Think about it. I mean, if you look at 1 Timothy 3, for example, can a non-Christian be the husband of one wife? Can he be temperate and prudent and respectable and hospitable and able to teach? Of course. In that most general context, yes, he can do all that. And yet Christ would not allow anyone other than a Christian to hold this office. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, it is a trustworthy statement. It's a faithful statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. Aspires and desires. Aspires means stretching forward something or stretching towards something, reaching after it, yearning for. Desire is the same word from which we get elsewhere in the New Testament for craving or lust. Obviously, it's used in a positive sense here, as word lust can be used in a positive sense, believe it or not. And it just simply means strong desire. And eldership is an honorable office, and therefore the man who seeks that office must be seeking it for the right reasons and not just, you know, I guess I have to. You know, it's purely a burden of his and by sheer obligation or even by guilt. While some characteristics are general, a candidate's must manifest his character as polished and refined and practiced. He did not just start doing these characteristics last week. You know, hey, I've been working on my elder characteristics for the last week. I've been doing pretty good. Okay, that's just not good enough, or even last month. But these have to be a regular part of his lifestyle for some time. I put a picture of some nice mature trees up here. Those trees have been working on being trees for a long time. That's why they look that way. And that's how we should be looking at men who we appoint as elders. We shouldn't look at them as little saplings just coming out of the ground. And we shouldn't look at them as bent over trees, just barely surviving, filled with disease and, you know, just barely hanging on. We should look at them as tall, straight, and very stable people. Okay, Psalm 1 comes to mind, like a tree planted by the water. Something that is well-nourished, well-taught, and manifests that nourishment, that teaching in his life. It also implies this is someone we have known for some time. How long is not necessary to establish, but we've known him long enough. You know, we wouldn't want a brand new person, even if he is seasoned and mature, we wouldn't want a brand new person to suddenly be nominated to be an elder here and chosen to be an elder here because we just don't know him personally. We want to be able to see these things for ourselves. So as we go through the character traits in 1 Timothy 3, starting in verse 2, I want you to consider also, how do you measure up to all this? I know we're looking at appointing elders, and we're looking at, anytime we're looking to appoint elders, we're looking at those specific candidates. At the same time, realize that these qualifications, if you want to call them that, or these lists here, they are describing a mature Christian individual more than anything. And how do you hold up to that? This is a picture of what every Christian ought to be striving to become. If you're not there yet, you ought to be striving to become this, what we're going to be talking about. Even if you, if reaching that may be years away, you should have that goal in mind. So what kind of man should he be? Well, above reproach, it says, or another version might say blameless. That doesn't mean sinless, because that's impossible. And it doesn't mean struggleless, because that's also impossible. But it means not living in guilt before God. I think of Noah there in Genesis 6, verse 9. Noah was blameless. He walked with God. Was Noah sinless? Oh, no. Was Noah unable to sin? No, that wasn't the case. But he did walk with God. He chose that. Not having a disreputable character like Esau, another negative example in this case, who was very unspiritual and just didn't regard very highly the inheritance that was offered him. The idea here and throughout this whole passage is that since these men represent God to their families and the congregation and the world, they need to be respectable and reverent men. We need to be able to see this. And I might ask, does this describe you? Are you working on that? Are you there now? Or are you striving to become that? Man needs to be temperate. Literally, that word means sober, like sober, not intoxicated with alcohol. But figuratively, it means vigilant or alert or focused or simply serious about his life and his family and his congregation. It doesn't take this superficially, doesn't treat it glibly, you know, like shrugging, like, yeah, oh, well, if the congregation's healthy, that's great. But if it's not, you know, another day, you know, just doesn't take it as a very cavalier thing. He takes it very seriously. And you might ask yourself, are you a temperate person? Are you sober-minded? Are you paying serious attention to your responsibilities and to yourself? He needs to be prudent, which literally means sober-minded or serious-minded or self-controlled, not driven by emotions nor quickly losing his attention, but disciplined to a godly lifestyle. Not just street smart or, say, computer savvy, okay? In other words, not just focusing on some particular skill set he might have or some particular knowledge he might have, but rather Bible-trained, if I could say it that way, trained in the Scriptures as to what he should be and what he should look like. And again, we can ask you, is that what kind of person you are or are striving to be? It's a prudent person. He needs to be respectable, or literally of good behavior, proper, dignified, as opposed to someone who is irrational, improper, and even unapproachable. Not only how he acts around his friends and family, but how he acts around all other people. I have heard it said you can tell a lot about a person by how they treat strangers and restaurant help, okay? Servers. And you've seen this before, I am certain. Someone is all happy and smiles and, you know, cordial with you, and yet turns to the help and treats them like they're just beneath him and expendable people. You want to be careful of such a person there. That's a hypocrite. And we don't want a hypocrite to be an elder for us. So, and again, how do you act around people that aren't your friends and family? I mean, are people expendable to you? Do you treat them that way? What would others say about you that are watching you? This man needs to be hospitable. Literally, in the Greek, it means lover of strangers. It's literally how it comes out. And that doesn't mean strangers like just people on the street. Technically, in the New Testament context, in fact, I can't even think of a time when the word strangers isn't referring to God's people who are unknown to those who are taking care of them. It always refers to that. I could go into passages to talk about that. And 3 John actually says that. 3 John, I think it's verse 5 through 8, where John explains to Gaius that he's writing to, and says, you take care of those strangers who are among us, who are out preaching the word and you know, traveling missionaries or traveling preachers, if you will. You take care of those. So what we're talking about then is a man who is willing to receive the brethren, especially in his own home. In the examples that I was looking at in the book of Acts, over and over and over, you see Christians taking other Christians, whom they did not know initially, taking these people into their homes. Well, what kind of people should we be? We should be that kind of people, shouldn't we? And we should want a man who is that kind of person to represent us and lead by example. A man whose home is off limits to the congregation sends a very negative message to the congregation that, hey, you're important to me when we're at church, or, you know, maybe if we happen to run into each other in another context, but I don't want you in my home. Just imagine what that says, what kind of signal that provides there. Here's a man who shows genuine interest and concern in those outside of his circle, outside of his family, outside of his social group, outside of his usual company of friends. Watch people, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. So let's turn it around and ask yourselves, what kind of people are you? What kind of person are you individually? Are you one that will not have anyone over in your home? And please don't give me the excuse that, well, I live in an apartment, I have no room. Okay, I'm not talking about physically. I'm talking about, you know, the kind of character that you have. I'm talking about, are you a kind of person that is receptive of the brethren, including those who you do not know well? And that says a lot about you, if you are. Able to teach. Literally, it means instructive. It implies well studied. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to have eloquence, gift of talk or gift of word usage or diction or something like that. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't require that. It doesn't require great oratory skill. I don't think I have great oratory skill. I don't need comments right here from any of you. Because some of you are probably going, yeah, you're right, it doesn't. I trip over my words, I say things wrong, and et cetera. I'm not the great orator. If you want a great orator, I would suggest maybe Charles Spurgeon or something like that. But that's not me. And yet, can I fulfill a particular function as a preacher? Well, that's the same thing of an elder. You know, he's able to communicate information effectively. It also means able to teach doesn't mean like if I have to teach, then I can. Like if the preacher calls me up and says, hey, I'm sick, can you do the lesson? I'm able to teach. I'm able to do that. That's not really what it's talking about. It means apt to teach and therefore is not passive but active. It's the same Greek word if you were to go to 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24, and it says that the Lord's bondservant must be able to teach. It's the exact same Greek word in the exact same context, but doesn't talk about elders. It talks about teaching. And so elders are to be teachers. They are to be actively teaching. In fact, in Titus chapter 1, verse 9, it says of elders specifically, candidates for elders, that they are to be able to exhort sound teaching, but also to refute unsound teaching. You can't teach what you don't know, and you can't refute what you don't know is false, okay? You have to know these things. I said that in another lesson, and I'll say it again, that is something that these men have to be able to do. 1 Timothy 3, verse 3, not addicted to wine. Well, literally means no drunkenness. He's not a drunkard. It implies self-control. It implies temperance. Can certainly be applied to other things such as drugs or smoking or swearing or pornography or gambling or food or whatever a person can become controlled by or addicted to. In other words, he's not addicted to the world. He's not addicted to things in the world. Now, I want to just say that doesn't mean that a man can't have struggles with those things. I've heard it said that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And I think that's true about other things too. Sometimes it's a day-to-day struggle. But here's a man who's not practicing these things. He's certainly not giving himself over to these things. And we could ask the same question about you. Is that describe you? Are you addicted to anything in this world? And if you are, then are you really going to point fingers at a candidate and say, well, he's addicted, you know, in my mind, or, you know, struggling in some way, and therefore, you know, that is inappropriate for him, but it's okay for me. It would be inappropriate for both of you. Let me just clarify. It would be inappropriate. He's not pugnacious, which is a word we don't use much. If you think about someone who is pugilant, same Greek or Latin root there, it just means he's a fighter. He's a brawler. Literally, it means not a striker in the Greek. Not prone to arguing and fighting, but he's approachable. Have you ever met someone that you try to talk to them and it's always a battle, a contest, a competition? They're always trying to one-up you or trying to correct you or trying to even threaten you in some way. That's what it's talking about here. We need elders who are approachable. And don't take everything so personally and sensitively that you can't even talk to them about anything without them getting upset or without them, you know, threatening you in some way. And that means you too, all of you, need to be not pugnacious, okay? Gentle and uncontentious, patient, not a fighter, again, willing to give people time and opportunity to change and to improve themselves, might be another way of looking at that. Not violent, not rough, not arguable. Again, that should be what we expect from every mature Christian. God has given you the basics here of what it means to look like a mature Christian person. Free from the love of money, or simply not covetous, not bound to a lifestyle that revolves around or is always focused on money and spending and materialism. Not greedy, not enslaved to those things would be synonymous with that. All right, so, you know, how about yourself? Are you that way, but you're looking through that very scrutinizing picture of some man? I realize that a man that you appoint as an elder should not be these things, but neither should you. In other words, is what I'm saying. 1 Timothy 3, verse 6, he ought not to be a new convert. Well, that just simply makes sense in my book. I mean, as I see it, you know, new converts just are unprepared. They're just unequipped or inexperienced, rather. Because an elder needs to deal with mature spiritual matters. Go to Galatians 6, 1 and 2 that we talked about in another lesson. Specifically, so they won't allow being an elder to go to his head. There's another aspect of that. It's not a time for power trips and ego trips and allowing himself to vaunt his pride and allow his pride to get in the way. It says in Ecclesiastes 10:16, for example, I believe it's there, that it says, woe to a nation whose king is a child. Okay, and in other words, a novice, someone who's an amateur, someone who's inexperienced. You don't want someone like that ruling in any capacity, managing or having, you know, as a shepherding role over a group of people. That's just not going to go well. 1 Timothy 3:7, I actually want to read that one. It says, he must have good reputation with those outside the church so they will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. In other words, with non-Christians, how does he act? At work, if he's in a secular job, in the neighborhood, in his community. I always think of Daniel when I think of this. You know, Daniel chapter 6, verse 4. Daniel's enemies struggled to find anything negative about him, either in his role as a seer or with the people at all. In other words, he's not a hypocrite. He's not religious and pious and cooperative with the congregation, but the community knows him otherwise, right? He's a different person out in the community. And so what about you? What kind of reputation do you have here? But also, what kind of reputation do you have outside? We should expect a good reputation from men who are seeking the position of an overseer. We should also expect a good reputation from you if you're striving to be a mature Christian man or woman. And this is a big deal, by the way. How we represent the church to the world is a big deal. And we all are representing the church to the world in our individual lives. So these are really a list of characteristics, not qualifications in the technical sense, but simply forming a composite picture of what kind of man we ought to be looking for. It is really the picture of a man of God, not a man who's simply filling a position or just simply someone who's trying to keep us away from having business meetings because we don't have elders. I've heard that said so many times in the past, not recently, thankfully, but I've heard that said, we need to have elders so we don't have to have business meetings because everybody hates business meetings, you know, where the congregation comes together and does business rather than having shepherds and overseers. That's just not the reason why we should be having elders and not the reason why we should be looking to appoint them. Sadly, many congregations have used these lists not to qualify candidates, but just the opposite, to disqualify them. They think that the goal is to find some defect or some deficiency or some disqualifying feature that renders that man who's being put forward as unfit. And as a result of that, many good men over the years and decades and even centuries, many good men have been denied being elders, not because they are imperfect men in this. Let me say, they've been denied because they're not perfect. Let me just say it that way. They've been denied because they're not perfect men. And yet those who have denied them are also imperfect and sometimes make no effort to improve themselves. So we want to look at, we're not trying to find a perfect man because we'll never do that. But at the same time, if you're looking for someone who is excelling in these different areas, well then you should be striving to excel in those same areas. You're asking someone to do something that you're not willing to do, that's the definition, really, of hypocrisy, a double standard. And furthermore, many existing elders in congregations everywhere are not actively and purposely training men. Apparently, we have it in our mind. I'm not saying this of just elders, but we congregations have it in our mind that men are just going to morph into maturity. They're just somehow going to, because they're older and they've got experience of marriage and child raising, that they're just going to train themselves or morph into model examples. First of all, I don't see that often happening. I do think some men are kind of self-initiated and do train themselves in some respect. But for the most case, my observation is that's not how it happens. Men need to be trained. Men need to be equipped. Men need leaders to lead them and guide them in their training. And, you know, I've been talking with Buck about this, about preacher training. I really, really wish I had had someone train me to be a preacher. It would have saved me years and years, possibly even a decade or so, of doing it the wrong way and trying to, you know, through trial and error. I wish I had had someone lead me. And the same token, I wish we had, elders in every congregation. I wish we had the mindset to have elders take men under their wing and say, if you want to be an elder, let me help you. Let me guide you. Let me teach you what it takes. And not just sit down over coffee and have a talk, but really take them through that training and say, this is what I've learned through my experience. And be realistic about that, okay? Because waiting for men to just step up to the plate is not realistic in itself. just waiting for that to happen as a solution to our need. And that can be said about preachers and deacons and everyone else as well. So if you want an idea of where God wants us all heading, the characteristics for candidates for the eldership gives us really an excellent portrayal of such people. These men in particular, yes, but of people, of Christians. From what the Holy Spirit has revealed and recorded and preserved for us, we can know what God is looking for when he talks in so many words about spiritual maturity. We're not going, well, I have no idea what he means. What does it mean to be spiritually mature? We can actually look into the word and find out exactly what he's talking about. What kind of character is he looking for? And it doesn't really come down to skill set and you know, his ability on a computer or his proficiency and, you know, building something or, you know, how well does he read or something like that. It's not really about that. It's more about what kind of man is he. Notice that what's not emphasized, skin color, social standing, level of education, the kind of job or house a man has, his economic status, his stand on the so-called brotherhood issues and things like that. But rather, what is important to God is always the same thing: matters of the heart, matters of conscience, moral purity. That's what God is looking for in all of us, specifically looking for in candidates for the eldership, those things: matters of the heart, his conscience before God, and his moral purity. I'd like to leave you with this passage here. We've cited it before, but here it is again. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13 and 14, Paul says, "Be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong, let all that you do be done in love." This is certainly expected of candidates for the eldership, but it ought to be the objective of all men and women in principle. Those who do so certainly find favor with God. And that's what I'm encouraging us all to do, is to live the kind of life and to be the kind of person and have the kind of thinking that finds favor with God, so that we can all stand before God someday together and understand that we did our job well, that he gave to us to do, so that he can say to us, "Enter in, good and faithful servants." That's what we want to hear. All right? That's our lesson for now. We do have another half of this lesson. You notice this is part one. We'll do the next part next week, okay? So for now, this lesson is yours, and to do with what you will. Hopefully you take it seriously and take it to heart. If there's anyone here that's ready to become a Christian or ready to really recommit himself or herself to being a Christian, and you need to come forward to do that, well, this is your opportunity. As we stand and sing the song Aaron has selected for us.